Welcome to Infrastructure Momentum Makers, presented by Ensurata, the only software solution purpose-built to securely run complex and high-value infrastructure procurement. All your infrastructure procurement processes in one place, all in order. And join me, Ratna Amin, as I speak with the movers and shakers at the intersection of the public, private, and civic sectors about the latest breakthroughs and developments in the world of infrastructure. Today, I'm so excited to be joined by former U.S. Deputy Chief Technology Officer, advisor, businesswoman, and leader in the tech and policymaking space, Jennifer Pulka. Jennifer is the author of the book, Recoding America, Why Government is Failing in the Digital Age and How We Can Do Better. Jennifer is here today to discuss her book, The Intersection of Government and Tech, plus so much more. Thanks so much for joining us, Jen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. So we're going to start off talking a little bit more about your background. You're an author, an advisor, a thought leader. You wear a lot of different hats. What are you working on now? What's your day-to-day like?
Oh, what a great question. Yeah, I think most people think of me as sort of in the civic tech world, but the frame for my work right now really is state capacity. And a lot of people interpret that to mean I'm working at the state level. It's a term more familiar to academics. It just means government capacity. And I think it flows naturally from the book that I wrote in that I was talking in the book about this gap between policy intentions and the actual outcomes. And capacity of government is that gap. So it certainly touches technology. And I think the ways we've moved into a digital world are part of that lack of capacity. But I'm really looking largely at that issue now. And I'm doing that through a fellowship at the Niskanen Center, another one at the Federation of American Scientists. I work with the Abundance Network here in California. And I'm on several boards of organizations that work towards building state capacity.
That's exciting to hear about. I'd love to hear you talk about your book, Recoding America. Everybody should read this book. For our listeners who haven't read it yet and might be interested in learning more, what are some key points you'd like to share?
Well, I think I already said the major one, which is that we need to recognize that we're living in an era where we are not consistently fulfilling the ambitions of the policy that we pass and policy and law that we pass. So what's the point if we are spending all of this energy on law and policy and then the outcomes we expect don't actually happen? Of course, with my background in building, say, interfaces to government for benefits or getting your kids in school, I also worked on the Defense Innovation Board. So it's sort of broad state, local, federal, and different policy domains sort of across the board. I come at it from really being able to tell the story of that gap between policy and implementation through the lens of digital teams who are increasingly charged with filling that gap, right? We implement policy very much through technology these days. At least it's involved in some portion of it. And I think where my work can sometimes get mistaken is that I'm saying technology is the solution. What I'm really saying is that there are ways that technology that does work in our private lives is built that we need to look at and learn from, and we need to start doing things in different ways. But that's really about things like centering it around the user, doing it iteratively, learning along the way, and really, I think fundamentally, closing that gap between the people who do the policy and the people who do the implementation. And you can see how that has played out in, say, the consumer tech world. But I'm not saying let's be like consumer tech. What I'm saying is there are things that we are doing wrong that are stuck in the way that we ran government in the 50s and the 60s and 70s that are no longer serving us. And we've got to grapple not with let's use more technology, but let's borrow from the practices of digital and just the way the world has changed and fundamentally update how we do government, which is why the title is Recoding America. And I don't mean rewriting the computer code as much as I mean rethinking how we do government in a very foundational way.
Thanks for that. Yeah, one of my favorite themes from your book was making services that make sense to a person or experiences that make sense to a person. And in my experience, it's easy to take many, many steps without checking if it makes sense to anybody.
Yeah. And I think that one of the things I'm trying to say now is that when I was running Code for America or helping stand up the United States Digital Service, I think it was really easy to look at the work we were doing as, oh, it's prettier, it's easier to use, it's simpler. Isn't that nice, right? Like, that's a nice thing to have. And, you know, I tell a story in the book about, for example, this implementation of a healthcare policy, MACRA, the Medicare Access and CHIP Reauthorization Act, where what they realized really early on is that having the website and system that's going to implement MACRA that doctors who take Medicare will use makes sense to the doctors isn't a nice to have. If they don't have it, if they don't get it to the point where it makes sense to doctors, they're already so frustrated working with Medicare. They're on the verge of revolt. And that if they come and see this new program that they're supposed to engage with, and it's the same legalese and, you know, incredible administrative burden, frustration, they're going to leave the program. And if they leave the program, then a law designed to improve the quality of care that Medicare patients receive is going to degrade the quality of care. And so it's core to fulfilling policy ambitions, not just a nice thing that looks pretty. And we've really got to shift our thinking in that way.
Do you feel like it is shifting?
Yes, I do. I feel like there's a lot of energy for shifting it. I think my biggest hope in the book was that, of course, I wanted it to resonate with the people who do digital service delivery, because in some ways that's the core of the stories and I wanted to be true to their work. But I really wanted to get beyond preaching to the choir. I wanted policy people and elected leaders and appointed leaders and people in the legislative branch, not just the administrative agencies, not just the executive branch, to start to see how big this problem is and how, frankly, they contributed to it. And so how they might contribute to alleviating it. We're nowhere near a mass solution to the problem, of course. There's been far more engagement outside of the circles that I was in dialogue with after the book than before. And I'm really pleased about that. People really get it and they want to know, what do we do next?
Oh, that's really great to hear. And I think your book does such a good job of educating folks. One of my favorite parts was your optimistic statement at the end that maybe we're moving into an era of greater state capacity around digital delivery. The last 10 or 20 years was this imbalance where most of that capacity was actually in the private sector, but it doesn't have to stay that way. We can actually shift the balance, which is a really hopeful and exciting vision.
Hopefully, we will look back on, say, this decade and say, these prior decades, when the private sector certainly dominated digital and really changed the world, was very interesting. A lot has been written about why it evolved the way it did. Like, how did we end up with a consumer tech ecosystem that's ad-driven, right? Like, it didn't necessarily need to be that way. But, you know, in my best world, we look back and say, the use of these tactics, not just the technology, but the practices like user-centered design that make things make sense to people, the best and highest use of these practices is in the public sector. And it makes sense with the where the internet came from and the values that drove it early on. It was supposed to be for all of us. And it may be that it's the public sector who really shows the true power of digital. And, you know, since we're talking about infrastructure, we need government to do things at a scale it hasn't done, I guess, possibly for a really long time. And you might even say ever, right? The amount of new infrastructure that we need to build. We need that state capacity, and working in these ways is how we're going to get that state capacity. So we kind of have no choice but to rise to the occasion.
Yeah, I think that issue of scale is important. I would agree. We've never had to create so much new infrastructure, but also the need to update, redesign, tend to existing infrastructure has never been greater either. So now we have this double challenge at the same time.
Very, very much. Yes. And that can operate on so many levels. I mean, it's physical infrastructure. It's the systems that govern building that physical infrastructure. And then layers down, it's the beliefs that inform those systems. One of those beliefs that has to change is the belief that government can't do this well. We have to believe it can. We have to believe that we can attract the best talent. There's enormous evidence towards both of those things. But if we believe it can't, we have shot ourselves in the foot from the beginning. And so those beliefs have to change, and they do really underlie the core infrastructure of our country.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about serving as Deputy Chief Technology Officer and what you learned in that role?
I came into the White House in the middle of 2013 to serve as Deputy CTO at a really wonderful boss named Todd Park. And he had launched something called the Presidential Innovation Fellows that was very similar to the nonprofit that I was running, Code for America, except it operated at the federal level. His pitch was to run that program, but I had, before accepting, said, I actually think what we need to do is build an equivalent in the US to the government digital service in the UK. And so my job there was split. The one I really wanted to do was get this USDS thing started. I mean, it became USDS. And along the way, 18F at GSA also got created in much the same mold, but with some different authorities and theories of change, but driven by these same principles we talk about in the book, like agile, iterative, user-centered development. I learned so much. You know, I had been working with Code for America for a couple of years. I'd founded the organization with, you know, I would say some degree of naivete about how government works, and had been already learning very quickly how to get through government and the challenges and opportunities that come with that. But I was still naive and still had this expectation that because my boss, the CTO, and a few other people, including Dan Tarolini over at GSA, supported the idea of this new unit, that I would just go in and build it. And of course, you go in and there's 7,000 other people that you have to sign off on this. That's the way we have built government, is extremely diffuse power. You think you're going in to build, you're really going in to sell for the right to be able to build. And I'm sure this resonates with many people listening. I think one of the things I learned, and I describe this in the book, is that the resistance to having a unit that does actual delivery, and we could talk about what delivery means, inside the White House was far greater than I ever imagined, for a lot of reasons. And one of those reasons is that the White House has a very long history, and especially OMB, the part of the White House that I was in, it has an identity as a policy institution. Policy institutions don't do delivery. There is, in fact, sort of a class structure in DC and actually in a lot of government that says the important thing, the thing that has high status, is policy. And delivery is a detail of implementation. Other people will handle that. I certainly felt that when I was making the case for USDS and getting a lot of resistance. And in writing the book, I did some research and found that back in the early 90s, we had the Clinger-Cohen Act. Some federal folks will know more about this. It's a law that passed to try to improve the quality of digital technology in government. It came right at that time when we were moving from, okay, you've got a PC in your office, to like Amazon and Google are changing the world, right? There's sort of new tools on the table, to there's a new society that we have to grapple with. And the authors of this act, Senator Clinger and Representative Cohen, were trying to get OMB, that same office, to take responsibility for digital strategy back in the early 90s. And OMB showed up at the hearings and argued against it. They didn't want that responsibility. And the line from the Deputy Director of Management at the time to these members of Congress was, it is operational in nature and therefore inconsistent with the policy role of this institution. And actually, I have great respect for that man who was the deputy director at the time, and I think he was a fantastic civil servant. But what he was expressing is that class divide, so to speak, or status divide, that keeps policy over here and implementation over here. And as long as we think that way, we will continue to have low capacity, a big implementation gap, and we're not really going to be able to solve the huge challenges in front of government today. And I felt that in my bones then, but I really put it all together when I looked at the history. That's what I was really learning when I was in the White House, was how deep the resistance to making implementation as important as policy goes.
Another aspect that I think you elevate, or part of the class structure, is the folks that I call them gardeners, the people who really have to know the stuff and redesign it, whether it's codes or processes, or they're just so deeply invested and committed to focusing on one problem until they get to the bottom of it.
I love that you call them gardeners. I just think it's so important to bring metaphors like gardening, because so much of our language is like, well, we need air cover, or these sort of mechanistic or militaristic things, but it's a better metaphor in so many ways. I've now been speaking also to audiences who are not in government, and they say, you know, I read your book, what do I do as just, you know, a citizen? And my answer to them has to do with gardeners, but it's what we think our elected leaders are supposed to do. Our leaders consider themselves to be gardeners, but only in the sense that they plant seeds in the ground. And if that seed turns into something that provides shade or fruit or flowers for the public, that's how they get elected or get their name on a post office or something. And of course, we need to recognize that we should not be celebrating all this seed planting if the plants don't grow. That's the key point of the book. But also that anybody who's ever gardened knows that putting the seeds in the ground is like 0.5% of the work. What's important? Weeding, the metaphor for which would be, hey, we've got a bunch of old laws and policies that are no longer serving us. They need to come out of the ground. Tending the soil, making sure it has water, testing it for the right pH, moving things to where they have the right amount of sun and shade. It's capacity work. And I think an important way to see this metaphor right now is that our elected leaders have just been like, I'm incented to plant, I'm going to plant, 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 and we've depleted the soil. If you say, whose job is it to take care of the civil service, the health, I don't mean like physical health, but like investing in the people who do government, making sure they've got the right skills, that they're getting trained, that we're hiring the right people, that we have enough of them, that we're not burdening them so heavily with all of these practices and processes that keep them from getting the outcomes that the public expects. If you ask whose job it is, our elected leaders think it's someone else's job, and it can't be. They now have to spend more time on tending the soil than they do on planting the seeds, i.e. putting in a bill. And they're only going to change that thinking when the public starts asking something different of them.
Oh, that's so helpful to hear. I love the picture that you paint there of all the parts of the system and how they interact and the changing roles of elected officials.
I mean, I think people feel it when you go into a government office that's charged with something massive and important. And there's so much of that right now with the Inflation Reduction Act and the CHIPS and Science Act. You've got these teams that are like, we're going to do big things. And we're all overworked. We're all really struggling. It's really hard to hire. Half our time goes into things that aren't productive. And it's like, I wish there were a magic bullet to give those people everything they need to get the job done, because the job is so critical. And it's the system, not the people. That's another thing I want the general public to understand, is the problem is not with public servants. It's with a system that tries to extract everything out of them without ever regenerating, giving them the resources to regenerate.
So working in civic tech often means working with diverse stakeholders. You've brought up or named many, many different stakeholders already who touch civic tech. How can one navigate the complexities of collaboration between government agencies, tech professionals, and the community? What advice do you have?
Yeah, I think that my advice in that department sort of boils down to a term that is often misunderstood and needs to be understood sort of more as a metaphor than an exact thing, but it's product management. And in government, we do a lot of project management, which my definition of project management is it's the art of getting things done. And people who are good at it are saints, and we worship them, and as we should. But product management is the art of deciding what to do in the first place. And there's often no role for that. And we have to do that. And it's sort of the difference, say, on a software project between spending several years developing a very long list of requirements, handing it off to a vendor, and the vendor's job is just to go fulfill all those requirements. What's missing there is the choices about what's important and how people actually react to the software. The people are missing, the priorities are missing, a product vision is missing. But the other thing that product managers do, and again, this is a role that you see in a typical consumer tech field, and I'm not trying to lionize consumer tech or the private sector, but I think there's something valuable there. what a product manager does is that they listen to everybody, but they try to put all of those views into context in various ways and try to see how you might be getting what you want, but later. You might be asking for X, but what you really need is Y. And a designer needs to make that translation. It's that old line that's attributed to Henry Ford regarding cars. If we'd asked them what they wanted, they would have said faster horses. So often we just say, oh, this department wants this, this department wants this. Our goal is to get everybody what they want. And we give everybody a bunch of faster horses instead of designing a car. But it doesn't mean you don't listen. It's not this anti-democratic thing. And I mean, sort of democracy grafted onto this often internal and somewhat external set of stakeholders. The goal is to understand everyone's needs, but not to literally give them exactly what they want, but to meet those needs. And I do think a lot of that practice can result in people being happier because they didn't get exactly what they wanted. They got something designed to meet their needs. But yes, it's also going to sometimes result in people being unhappy in the short term. And that makes it a fundamentally political job. And we in government are simply going to have to do a better job of realizing that not everyone is always going to be happy in the short run, but we are constantly in business of making trade-offs. And we serve ourselves best when we pull back and look at those trade-offs, not in that particular moment, but in the context of the bigger goal that we have, right? So this is a classic thing, I think, more in your world around building infrastructure, is we're going to hear voices that say, this particular project may harm this horny toad frog. I care about species diversity. I care about all of that. But if you pull back and say, we have a critical need to decarbonize. In order to decarbonize, we need to build. If we don't decarbonize, not only that horny toad frog, but a whole lot of other species are going to die and never come back. Then sometimes you're going to have to make somebody unhappy in the short term for the long-term gain of something that I think is literally an existential threat, which is if we don't decarbonize, we hit a tipping point in climate change. And that takes leadership and it takes guts and it takes pissing somebody off. And our government isn't set up to do that. It's set up to make everybody happy. If we can redefine that role or bring in more of that idea of product management, somebody who's willing and empowered to make decisions in a way that's still really consistent with the overall goal and the common need and the public good, I think we can get a lot farther.
That's so robust in imagining somebody in that role and how important that role is with that conviction and that freedom to help prioritize and make trade-offs. We always call that the Christmas tree problem.
Yes, yes.
What makes you most optimistic about the future of the ways tech intersects with government?
One thing that makes me really optimistic is the number of people who want to come into government now. I mean, that's particularly true of the tech sector, but it's certainly not limited to that. I think the pandemic reminded folks how much government matters. I think global affairs reminding people of the same thing. And I think there's just starting to be more of a sense that government is where you can have big impact. And as the world gets, frankly, to me, scarier and scarier, impact is more important to people. They always say personnel is policy. Like the fact that we're getting such interest from people wanting to work on these problems in government, also in consultancies, in nonprofits that are working on these big problems. So I think fundamentally, this will be solved by people, but it'll also be solved by people who recognize that we're in a crisis. And I think we're pretty much aligned around the fact that we're in a climate crisis, that we're in a global instability crisis, that we're in a crisis of inequality. But we need people to translate that into a crisis of state capacity. The fact that we fight so hard for the political will to pass, for instance, the Inflation Reduction Act or the Bipartisan Infrastructure Bill, and then we are not getting that work that law enables done, that's a crisis. And if we admit that that's a crisis, then we start to make different trade-offs. I think about this general category of over-proceduralization. There's a lot you could say about NEPA or the environmental impact statement process. Yes, it's necessary. It's also slower than it needs to be. I think we largely agree on that. Some of that is stuff that can be solved with tools. Substantively, someone can product manage the process and say, here are the big important parts we can't lose. These other parts are going to fall by the wayside. They're optional anyway, really. I'm just going to make the call that in order to get this done faster, we're going to take some of these procedures off because the value they provided as a safeguard at one time is no longer worth the delay that they cause. But most of the DoD will still tell you we are shackled by literally hundreds of thousands of pages of policy that govern what we do, processes that have accumulated over decades. It is so hard to move. We're running through molasses here, right? I think that when those people come in and bring a recognition that we are in fact in a crisis that requires the administrative state to move faster and more decisively, it's the people and it's the thinking that gives me the hope. I wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post a couple months ago that was grumpy at the current administration about not taking this seriously enough as a crisis. Things like the fact that it takes longer to hire now in federal government than it did under Obama, right? That's not okay. There was a comment on the blog from a guy who says, I'm a 34-year civil servant. It's never been this bad. We've never been this risk averse. It's never been this slow. And he ends saying, we are murdering the mission. And I'm glad he used that word mission because that's what people come to this work for is the mission of building something that people really need.
For leaders of agencies or elected officials or somebody with that kind of authority or power, how would you concisely describe the act of cleaning up the molasses? Let's say taking a year or 2 years, we're going to clean up all the molasses so then we can operate and pursue the mission in a cleaner, more efficient way.
Well, first of all, I think very few leaders can or do make that a priority. I've seen a lot of elected leaders at all levels say to me, oh, I'm going to run this city or department, and I really want your advice because I want to clean up the molasses. If they don't, before they start, appoint somebody whose job that is and have an agreement about how to empower that person, they take the job, they're overwhelmed with 17,000 crises, and they are fundamentally reactive the whole rest of the time. I've learned this from colleagues like my friend Marina Nitza, who's profiled pretty heavily in the book. When she went into the VA, they said to her, we want you to fundamentally transform the VA. And by the way, you have no staff and no budget. And she is superhuman, so that didn't daunt her. She still took on that challenge because she's incredibly powerful and brilliant and good-minded person. But she said to this leader, one of the things I need is I'm going to need to be able to come in your office a couple times a month. You need to take that meeting. I will be very brief. I'm going to bring someone else in and you're going to have to back me. I think the fundamental understanding was you don't have to listen. You just need to back me. If you believe that I can transform this, that the things that I need to get done, that cleaning up work, that making us an operationally effective delivery organization is important to you, then you've got to trust me to do it and you've got to back me. So often I see people hire folks for that job and then just have no time for them. I'm not criticizing leaders. What I'm saying is ahead of time, giving that leader 20 minutes a week to clear obstacles for them and back that person in their effort, you're going to go a lot further. But that's only one of several things. I mean, we talk about the DoD. The saying is the policies that govern the DoD amount to 100 copies of War and Peace. I've heard about teams who spent an entire year trying to figure out if they had the policy authority to do a simple thing, right? There's an incredible need to just declutter and spring clean. Congress and legislative bodies have to buy in on this. Like administrative agencies can't do it alone, but I think administrative agencies are going to have to start it. We live at the dawn of the AI age. It's a great way to ingest an enormous amount of language and suggest simplifications to it. I think one of the best places you could do this is unemployment insurance. It varies by state. In New Jersey, they say it's 7,119 pages of regulation that govern the delivery of something that, frankly, is pretty simple. Let's try getting some AI models to ingest that content and go look at the things that are either outdated, conflicting, unnecessary, we as humans will still make the choices about what's important to have in our policy, but we can't be governed by 90 years of clutter and policy craft. The unemployment insurance goes back to the 1935 Social Security Act. We have added rules and regulations to that program for 90 years without ever subtracting from them. AI is not a silver bullet, but it is a tool to help us say, what would the policy governing a program like that look like if we were to have designed it today? It just wouldn't have accumulated all of that junk. I think our legislatures are so obsessed with A, regulation of AI in the private sector, and B, use of it in the public sector to replace humans. That's the wrong way to think about it. There's huge benefits to AI, but they should start with legislators looking in the mirror and saying, we have always added, never subtracted. AI can help us do that. Who can help us with the AI?
What a powerful recommendation. I hope people run with that, thinking about AI that way. I have two last questions that we've asked all of our guests. I'm sure the work you do can be stressful or pull you in a lot of directions. Where do you find order in the chaos?
Oh, order is overrated. Embrace the chaos. I think having some guiding principles really has helped me. Like stopping and writing the book and then figuring out how to talk about what's in the book. I say to myself, are we working in a mandate and constraint model? Or are we working in an enablement model? And that gives me some order by which to think about what I want to tackle and how others want to engage with me, right? It's like order also comes from the relationships you have and whether you're aligned around those relationships. So that's been really helpful. And I think clarifying those for myself is a process. It's not like a moment in time when you have it. But ultimately, I think what brings me the most sense of purpose is those relationships. The idea that we have something in common. It's not just a logical sense of what's wrong, but it's a deep feeling about what's wrong and why it's important to us as individuals. And I think that creates some sort of order. I think I get my sense of order from that sense of connection.
So one last question before I let you go. Is there any major infrastructure project anywhere in the world that's on your bucket list to go and see one day? And that could be any type of infrastructure.
I guess I will cheat the question a little bit and say, I would like to go see the infrastructure that hasn't yet been built in this country that enables decarbonization. Those transmission lines across state lines, the things that are going to enable our new grid as we get them up. Let's have a whole industry of tourism to see the things that are going to save us from climate change.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Jen, so much for being on the Infrastructure Momentum Makers. This was amazing.
Thank you, Rana. It's great to talk to you again, great to reconnect, and great to talk about all this important stuff.
Our guest today, once again, was Jennifer Palka. Jen, thanks so much for joining the show to tell us about your book and your exciting work. It's been a real pleasure. And thank you all once again for listening to our show. If you're enjoying it, please make sure to leave a review so more people can find us. Until next time, I'm Ratna Amin, and this has been Infrastructure Momentum Makers, presented by Ansarada.